Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, where we're dedicating this week's programme to an update on the UK's climate change bill. On the bill's second reading in the House of Commons back in June, the government announced that it would be deleting key amendments to the bill made by the House of Lords. That same day, development charity Christian Aid released a press release saying that the government had eviscerated the bill. I asked Elliot Whittington, Christian Aid's senior advisor on climate change and sustainable development, about their concerns.
The first one, I believe, is that do you believe that the overall level of ambition is far from what it should be?
Yeah, I mean, Christian Aid is very clear that if you look at the science and you look at where the political weight in terms of where people have drawn a line in the sand, if you like, in terms of what needs to happen to prevent catastrophic climate change, there's a lot of consensus around keeping global warming under 2 degrees. And the science says that if you're going to have a reasonable chance of doing that, then you've got to see big cuts in global emissions of the order of about 80%. And as an industrialised country with probably one of the biggest shares in terms of historical emissions, we've really got to be looking at those kind of order of cuts in the UK. So anything less than 80% as part of this bill just is falling short in terms of what's necessary to avoid catastrophic climate change.
No one would really defend scientifically the current 60% by 2050 target, would they?
I don't think they would, to be honest. I mean, I think there are some people who point to something that is more cost-effective, but I think if you look at the consensus science, if you look at where the IPCC report has come down, there is a lot of weight behind the fact that if you're going for a higher target, then you're part of a global pathway that is putting us on a track to a 50% or greater chance of exceeding 2 degrees, and then you're looking at a number of quite catastrophic impacts that are really going to hit poor people in the developing country worst.
I can quote Hilary Benn himself here from his press release back in 18th of February, where he says, "The scientific evidence has moved on rapidly, and as part of a new global climate deal, developed countries may have to cut their emissions by as much as 80% by 2050. So he's even admitted it himself.
And I think there is that sense. I think the government are sort of aware that their target is out of date. Of course, what they're saying is that they need a process to take it further. And we're saying, well, there is nobody out there who is saying that 60% by the UK is adequate. If you look at even, you know, the UN Development Programme, they did a report surveying action on climate change, and they singled out the UK climate change bill as one of the first of its kind, really, as a great step forward, but saying that if everybody followed this level of ambition, then the world would fail to deal with climate change. So I think there is a strong message to say that 60% is not enough. We shouldn't be passing a bill with something that everybody knows is wrong. Let's start at 80% and then let's have a process to examine whether that's adequate or whether you actually might even need to tighten it further.
So the current position is that Hilary Benn is kind of contracting out, if you like, the decision on this to the Committee on Climate Change that they've set up. But I notice that committee is being asked to take into account a range of factors, not only the environmental science. They're also being asked to take into account technological, economic, fiscal, social and international factors, as well as energy policy when giving its advice. So we can't guarantee that they're going to come up with some advice that is based on the science rather than all these other factors.
Well, you can't guarantee. And the important thing here is that the UK has committed itself to saying that 2 degrees is the level that we should aim at as a world, that anything higher than that is likely to be unacceptable. And the UK has also committed itself to say that we should have a fair way of sharing out the global burden. So we're just saying that actually, well, if you take those two principles and look at the implications of that and then look at the science, then you are looking at 80% or more. And I don't think that there is anybody credible who would disagree with that.
So Stop Climate Chaos Coalition and Christian Aid, what are you asking for in terms of the current bill as it finalises its way through Parliament in terms of targets? You'd still like to see a target in there rather than wait for the advice from the so-called independent committee?
Yeah, I mean, we would like to see that target strengthened on the face of the bill. We can't see the sense in passing a bill with a figure that everybody knows is incorrect, particularly given that the bill doesn't have any reference to its overall objective in terms of global warming. You know, that one of the things that we organised and we lobbied with successfully within Parliament in the Lords to get into the bill was that the purpose of the bill should be about the UK's contribution to bring global warming under that 2 degree centigrade target, and that was taken out by the government. Now, if they're not willing to put their own policy target into the bill, and they're not willing to sign themselves up to a target that everybody knows is about the least that's adequate, then, yeah, we do feel slightly suspicious about a process that defers it down the line, and we would like to start with a number that there's a lot more consensus around, rather than a number that pretty much nobody will stand up and defend on its own merits. They'll only defend it on the basis of what's there anyway.
There was a huge consultation, or there was a huge number of responses to the government's consultations, something like 17,000. And I think I'm right in saying, I don't know the percentage, but the majority of respondents agreed that a higher target than 60% should be part of the legislation. Is that correct?
To my knowledge, yeah, although I'm obviously not the government and didn't receive all those okay. responses, so I don't have them
okay.
in hand. But yeah.
What's the level of support within the House of Commons for an increased target?
Well, I think the level of support is quite considerable, and particularly amongst Labour MPs, because you've got to note that Lib Dems have committed themselves already to 80% or more. They clearly see the argument. The Conservatives have said that they believe in an 80% target, although they do also believe that actually that target needs to be put directly into the hands of the committee. At the moment, it's simply the committee would make a recommendation and then the government would take that forward. But there have been early day motions put down, and we're seeing hundreds of Labour MPs signing up to those motions. So it looks very clear that there is a majority in the House of Commons that would support a strengthening of that target.
How worrying is it that the bill no longer contains a reference to staying within 2 degrees C? I understand that has been removed during the committee stage.
It was removed during the committee stage in the House of Commons, that's correct. Yeah, I mean, if the targets within the bill were adequate, then you might feel confident that actually that overall purpose isn't necessary. But because they are inadequate and because we know that there are processes taking it forward, without something that sets out the overall purpose of the bill very clearly in terms of the climate science and in terms of an adequate target, it really does open the door for a change in policy, moving the goalposts and just simply abandoning a necessary target, a necessary level of ambition that would avert catastrophic climate change. It just allows the moving of the goalposts in that way that is slightly worrying.
Right, I mean, what's the government's argument on this? That it's outside their control, really, because it's an international target. Surely it just must be a case of finding the form of wording that works.
Yeah, and I think we've been trying to put forward forms of wording. I mean, it clearly delivering 2 degrees by themselves, you know, that the UK should single-handedly be held to account for that is ridiculous and not something we would be looking to deliver. But we do think that within the scope of a global agreement and within the scope of global efforts, you can clearly identify, is the UK doing its bit or not? And that's very much what we seek to hold the UK to account for.
Moving on to aviation and shipping, this has been something that people have been campaigning for, Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, right from the outset, and it's still not in the bill. It was removed again by the government in the last committee stage, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, although what the government have included at this point is something that sets out that they will include aviation and shipping from the second of the budget periods created by the bill. And that is a good thing, and I think we're quite close to a meeting of minds here. We're getting to the stage where it looks like we will be able to find agreement. Now, the only thing about this so far is that the government have included a bit of an opt-out, and they're saying that they will either include aviation and shipping from the second budget period, or they will set out why they can't do that or why they're not going to do that. That's quite a broad opt-out, and we want to say, well, yeah, okay, if you get to the second budget period and you've got an international way of dealing with this, fine, you can do it that way. But if you haven't, and you're not going to get one in the next year or so at that point, then you've just got to bite the bullet and include them in the UK thing. We can't see a scenario where the UK backs out of all responsibility for these considerable and growing emissions. These are very much part of our economy, and as has been said on many occasions by Friends of the Earth, by some ministers and others, not counting these emissions is like going on a diet and not counting chocolate cake as part of it.
Under the Kyoto Protocol, the UK is already reporting annually on aviation and shipping emissions, and so a basis already exists on which emissions from aviation and shipping are apportioned.
Yeah, that is true. I think we would say, if we had the power to write this bill ourselves, we would say actually there's no reason whatsoever that you couldn't include aviation from the get-go, that there is a fairly well understood way of divvying things up. You might want to refine that within the scope of an international agreement, but it's not too hard to divvy up those emissions to national responsibility, and you should be doing it from the get-go. On the other hand, we do recognise that shipping does prompt other problems, that where you can have a boat that is going under the flag of one country that is going between two other countries, that is stopping and taking fuel on in international waters from a boat under the flag of a fourth or fifth country, that you do find these international problems piling up. So we're open to giving a bit of flexibility on that one, to say that there should be one of these five-year budget periods for the government to look at it, work out how you might internationally divvy up those kind of emissions. What we're not accepting is the idea that just because it's difficult that they can be left out of the picture, because clearly at some stage they have to be accounted for.
It's important, isn't it? I mean, it's not an insignificant amount. The Tyndall Centre have been saying that by 2030 aviation, if it continues to grow on the government's current projections, it could represent 70% of our total carbon budget by 2030. So it's not an insignificant amount. It's quite critical to getting this right.
Exactly. I mean, I think at the moment you could say that aviation and shipping as emissions, as percentages of the whole, aren't huge, but certainly aviation is the fastest growing source of emissions, at least before the fuel crisis anyway, and for us not to include it just allows that sector to grow at the expense of others, and without, you know, taking full responsibility for the emissions that we cause as an economy.
After the second reading in the House of Commons, Christian Aid issued a press release saying that the government had eviscerated the climate change bill, which is quite a strong statement. I mean, besides the lack of ambition and scientific rigour that the target currently represents, there's also a big get-out clause in effect for the UK, where we can buy our way out of making actual emissions cuts at home.
Yeah, and this is a very big source of concern to Christian Aid and other organisations, that the targets in the bill as such apply not necessarily to our actual emissions, but what's called the UK's carbon account, which is a combination of our emissions and the balance of our emissions once you take into account carbon trading, that's the buying and selling of carbon credits from external places. Now, you have different things there. You've got the European Emissions Trading Scheme, where you've got a Europe-wide cap and an attempt to cut carbon emissions in the European power sector, and that's one thing. But there's a very clear get-out that's available within that, and that's the ability to buy in what are sometimes called offsets or carbon credits from developing countries where their emissions aren't capped. Now, Christian Aid has a very big concern about this. On the one hand, it very much loosens the strength of the cap. It provides a get-out for the UK government and for companies in the UK, that should the cap in the UK be biting a bit too hard, that they can start to pay for projects in developing countries and ease the pressure on themselves, thus just basically avoiding doing what they need to do, which is stopping emitting as much carbon, and that's very concerning. The other thing is that we, you know, if you look at science, if you look at the level of cuts that we need in the world, we actually are going to need to see cuts in developing countries take place on top of those cuts that we see here. Now, it's not fair to expect developing countries that have to struggle with massive burden of poverty to pay for all of that themselves. So Christian Aid is very much of the opinion that we need to be financing cuts in developing countries on top of our reductions at home, and we can't be trading off one thing against the other. And basically, we can't be shifting the burden that falls on us in terms of decarbonising our own emissions onto those countries that are least capable of doing that, that have the least resources to do that.
Isn't this kind of approach also kind of contrary to the spirit of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change?
I don't think you can really say that, because I think actually, to a certain extent, it's using the framework that certainly was set up under the Kyoto Protocol, which is obviously a protocol under the UNFCCC, under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. So in some senses, this approach is in tune with that. But certainly, if you look at the messages that have come from developing countries within those negotiations, they've been very clear that they need what's called measurable, reportable, and verifiable financial support and transfer of technology to help them deliver cuts in their emissions. And they've been very clear that that needs to happen on top of significant emissions cuts in industrialised countries. And I think that's what's not happened so far. Under the Kyoto Protocol, you know, the bit that we always hear about is the cuts that rich countries signed up to, that they actually, in many cases, haven't delivered, although the UK is on track to meet its Kyoto target, largely because it switched its energy production from coal to gas, which was down to Maggie Thatcher's policies in the 80s. So there's that thing. But the bit of the Kyoto Protocol we hear less about was this finance being transferred to developing countries, and largely that hasn't really happened. So I think in letter, what the UK is proposing is very much in tune with the negotiations, but in actual fact, in spirit, I think that it falls very far short of what is required.
Between 2004-2006, virtually all the UK's claimed reductions in emissions has come from buying credits rather than making emissions cuts here in the UK. And what was originally, I think in the original draft of the bill, was that up to 50% of carbon credits were allowed as a way of meeting the targets in the bill. Now, that limit was reduced, I think, in the House of Lords. Is that right?
Actually, within the original text of the bill, there was no limit placed on how much the UK could meet its targets through buying in carbon credits. And that is very concerning, obviously. Now, what was introduced in the House of Lords was an amendment that said, actually, 70%, so just over two-thirds of the reductions needed to be met through real domestic effort, that you couldn't buy in credits to meet that 70% of the reduction. And that was because, basically, that the House of Lords identified this as the biggest loophole in the bill, and they felt that that loophole needed to be closed. The 70% number wasn't really drawn from anywhere. It was just saying this was roughly where they felt a reasonable marker needed to be placed. The government have taken that out completely. Now, again, there is no limit within the bill on how much of the targets can be met. And the only check and balance is that the Climate Change Committee set up by the bill should be saying how much of our targets should we be meeting by credits and what kind of credits should we be using. So there is that element. The problem is that this kind of approach just leaves the door open for exactly what you said, the UK not making significant efforts to cut their carbon emissions, but actually just relying on the fact that they can buy in credits to meet their targets. And if that approach is followed by all industrialised countries, then basically we're not going to avert climate catastrophe. We're going to be carrying on with business as usual, a slightly more expensive business as usual, but not anything that's going to achieve anything.
One thing that the Christian Aid has been pushing for in particular is for an amendment, which I think was accepted by the House of Lords, which is for UK companies to disclose the amount of carbon emissions raised by their activities, including their activities and financing abroad, because that is quite a significant amount. But again, I think the government has removed that from the bill during the committee stage.
Yeah, Christian Aid is very concerned with the fact that quite often we talk about our responsibility for emissions being in terms of the emissions that purely take place within our borders, which is something like 2% of global emissions on a year-on-year basis. Now, if you start to look at the amount of emissions financed through the City of London, which says that the top FTSE 100 companies are basically responsible for somewhere between 12 to 15% of global emissions.
That's research that Christian Aid did, yeah?
Yeah, that's research that Christian Aid supported. It was actually done by an organisation called Trucost, which does a lot of this kind of modelling, and has worked with a number of big investors in the city. So it's quite credible stuff. And I think we're keen to expose that global footprint that the UK has, because particularly in a world where often the message that goes out to people is what we do in the UK is irrelevant, it's all about China. Well, China's emissions in very large part come from producing goods that we consume in the West. Now, that doesn't mean that China gets off all responsibility for those emissions, but it does mean that we don't get off all responsibility for those emissions as well. We have to have some awareness of that supply chain. And in a process like the Climate Change Bill, where we're trying to reduce our domestic footprint, we think it's important that the UK isn't unaware of its global footprint, that it looks at how the goods that come into the UK bring their own carbon footprint, and it looks at the wider impact of industry. Because what can't happen is we bring down our emissions in the UK by offloading industries onto developing countries, and then hence adding to their footprint, because that doesn't get anybody anywhere. So I think there is a big concern there, and that's why we've been trying to push for this added transparency. At the moment, a number of companies say something about their carbon footprint, but they don't say very much. And what's missing is any sense that you can start to compare and contrast and get useful information out of that data. A lot of companies that say things about their global footprint don't even give you any numbers about it. And there are a number of voluntary standards out there that are supposed to try and bring people together, but it's not working. So we have been very strongly arguing that the Climate Change Bill should create a single mandatory standard produced by the government that brings all of that data together. So between similar companies, you can compare their carbon footprint and say, actually, I understand, you know, Tesco has a bigger footprint than Marks and Spencer's, but relative to its size, that makes sense, or it doesn't make sense. You can start to make those judgments, and particularly investors, those with the money, can start to make those judgments. Now, we did succeed in getting that in the House of Lords, but the government have turned around and said that they thought that making that mandatory is too strong. So they've changed what we put in the House of Lords and suggested that they will produce a new voluntary standard. Now, there are quite a lot of voluntary standards out there. I think a government initiative under the bill to produce a new one will take us somewhere, but ultimately we think it's got to be mandatory. If you're going to have any kind of impetus to change things, for companies to come together around a single standard, there's got to be basically a line in the sand which says at this point it will be law to obey the standard. So we're trying again to amend the bill to say in 2 years' time, in 3 years' time, that will be a mandatory standard.
Well, I think you've already made the point that this would be important because it would affect investment decisions. So people like pension funds, for example, who want to reduce their exposure to the risks posed by fossil fuels to their long-term investments would actually start to make investment decisions based on this. I mean, the government is arguing that it's not persuaded that mandatory reporting is an effective means of encouraging emissions reductions, but it would clearly influence investment decisions.
Given that the government's model for a solution for climate change is all about attaching a cost to carbon emissions, making it more expensive to emit carbon, making the polluter pay, given that that's the model that they sign up to, transparency, so you can see which companies are incurring which costs, is really going to help transform companies' behaviours when those costs come in. It's a fairly straightforward argument, and it basically says let the money follow the low carbon pathway rather than being invested in a hidden way in expensive coal-fired power stations or whatever that in 5 years' time might turn out to be a bad investment, and nobody will know because they won't be looking at the carbon footprint of their investment.
So the support from the opposition parties for this mandatory reporting as well, yeah? And as you say, the Lords have supported it. And also note that there's quite a good body of opinion within the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry, which also supports this.
Yeah, it's such a just simple and straightforward idea that actually it's been picking up support from left, right and centre, to coin a phrase. Yes, the Lib Dems have been very, very supportive and they've been championing it in the Parliament. The Conservatives have very much come on board behind it, and in fact the report that they did last year from John Gummer and Zach Goldsmith did list it as one of the key things that need to be taken forward, and that's something that the Conservative Shadow Cabinet has picked up and adopted, saying that this is a simple and necessary step that should be taken. And yeah, more and more businesses are starting to pick up on it, and the CBI said, yes, depending on how it's done, we support it in principle. So there is a very wide set of support for this. It just needs the government to seize the moment, take some leadership and step forward, because it's a very simple, very quick win that they could do. But at the moment, as I say, they're failing to step up to the mark.
I understand you've been running a campaign on it and that 20,000 people or so have responded to it, texting, emailing and sending postcards to the government. There's also an early day motion in the House of Commons. Is that still open? Is that something that people should be petitioning their MPs about still?
Definitely. As many MPs as possible to sign that. As I say, we are gratified to have the support of the opposition parties, so particularly if we could get Labour MPs to sign that. You know, we'll start to get that kind of critical mass where the government will realise that they've got no option but to take this forward. And I think already they're realising, given that when we first launched a campaign on this, the government response was, oh, this will never work. And now they've got to the stage of going, well, we're going to look at it, we're going to introduce a voluntary standard, we might make it mandatory. We've come a long way. So I think, you know, this is one of those instances that shows how campaigning and public pressure can really work. And as I say, it's a very simple idea. So yeah, get behind it, speak to your MP, get them to sign the relevant EDM, and it will really make a difference.
What happens next in terms of the timetable with all this? It's had three readings in the House of Lords and there's one more reading in the House of Commons left, is that right?
Started in the House of Lords and it's gone through the process in the House of Lords. In the Commons it's done the majority of its process, and what's left is basically what's called the report stage and the third reading that's going to take place on the 28th of October. At that point, there is one last chance for people to move amendments and vote on them, and that's a bit of a crunch point. So we shall see what changes happen at that point. After that, the changes made in the Commons will go back up to the Lords. So where you've had things that were made in the Lords and then kicked out, the Lords will have a chance to review the Commons' changes. And it may be on something like the offset issue, which the Lords felt very strongly about and which the government had been trying very hard to resist in the Commons, that we might actually see this kind of ping-pong where the Houses disagree and you find the bill moving backwards and forwards between them. But assuming that we get a good, strong bill and that both Houses agree on it, we should be well on track to get royal assent and the bill done by end of November.
What can listeners do who want to make this happen? If listeners want to help the campaign to make sure that this bill, as it gets down to the wire, is one that allows this country to play a fair and leading role in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and playing its part in avoiding dangerous climate change and actually showing the way, because I understand that campaigns for similar bills have now started in other countries.
I mean, this is one of the wonders of our parliamentary democracy, that I know it can come in for a bad name in many occasions, often justified, but actually here's something where it's really been working. This bill wasn't a government idea, it wasn't David Cameron's idea, it was the idea of Friends of the Earth, to give them their credit. And it's been solid campaigning that got this bill into Parliament, and it's been solid campaigning that has made a number of improvements to the bill and are making more. So do feel empowered, I think, to go and see your MP and go and talk to them about what the changes you want to see, particularly, obviously, if they're a Labour MP. Now, there are EDMs down about the target and the aviation and shipping, and there's an EDM by Elliot Morley about the mandatory reporting. So if your MPs haven't signed those, then they should be signing them. And you can find information about those on Christian Aid's website and on other Stop Climate Chaos members' websites. And, you know, if your EDM is agreeing with that and has signed the EDMs, then, you know, ask them are they going to vote for these things when it comes to the crunch, because that's ultimately what it comes down to. You know, if the numbers are there in terms of MPs who are going to put their vote where their mouth is, then the government will have to listen to us and they will have to make those changes.
And we've got an opportunity yet again, haven't we, to lead the way internationally and show some leadership. I mean, if we pass a flawed bill, surely that will pave the way for other flawed bills. Yet if we pass an effective bill, that will pave the way for other countries to also pass effective bills.
Very much so. I mean, this bill is the first of its kind in the world, and we've been very keen to welcome the government's commitment in terms of introducing it. But we don't want to pass one that is a flawed template for others to follow. We want to pass one that shows exactly what a country taking climate change seriously looks like. The government often talks about, you know, leadership on the world stage on climate change. Now, a strong climate change bill will deliver that, but a weak one is not going to be convincing. Other countries are watching this and they know the debate. They're not going to be fooled by something that doesn't come up to the mark. So yeah, this is a real opportunity to influence a global debate, and people should feel through their MPs that they've got a real voice on that, and that's something to be excited by and proud of.
One of the things that is a bit of a stumbling block at the UN talk seems to be the fact that the developing countries don't see real, genuine leadership from developed countries. This would give us the kind of credibility that would help move the talks along.
A strong climate change bill is very much going to be part of showing developing countries who currently don't believe that we're really that serious about dealing with climate change that we are. It's not going to be enough by its own right. We need to see other things like significant sources of funding for adaptation and mitigation in the developing world. We need those on the table as well. But one of the key parts of that is showing that we're serious about cutting our own emissions. And at the moment, I don't think we've convinced anybody of that. So the Climate Change Bill is a chance to do that, and that's why, among other reasons, that we ought to be pushing on doing it.
That was Elliot Whittington, Christian Aid's Senior Advisor on Climate Change. You've been listening to the 300 to 350 show. For more information and to access our archive of programmes, please visit www.climateradio.co.uk.